Welcome to the Due Diligence Podcast, where we explore how leaders make and execute their biggest decisions, from transactions to founding organizations to career pivots and beyond. This podcast is produced by Sleeping Giant Capital. We connect executive talent and capital to invest in West Michigan businesses. To learn more, visit us at sleepinggiantcapital.com or stop by our office in downtown Kalamazoo.
Marianne Martin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Doug.
So today we're joined by, I'm going to introduce you guys, Marianne Feldman, who is the Watts Professor of Public Policy and Management at the Watts College of Public Service and Community Solutions at Arizona State, and also Research Director at the Global Center for Technology Transfer. And we also have Martin Kenny, who is a Distinguished Emeritus Professor of Community and Regional Development at the University of California, Davis, and Senior Project Co-Director at the Berkeley Roundtable on the International Economy. And Marianne and Martin, I got connected to you through your wonderful book, which we'll be talking about today. They're co-authors of the book, Private Equity and the Demise of the Local. And this was actually a great book that I got turned on to. I think I saw it on LinkedIn. And your book, I thought, was really important for us to understand what private equity does and how it's reshaping community. But it also really brings into focus why ownership and place matters and how that's often overlooked. And so as an investor, I was very interested in having the opportunity to talk to both of you. We're at Sleeping Giant really looking at a place-based alternative to private equity. And so really wanted to spend some time with you, kind of going a little bit more behind the book. Why did you decide to write it? We'll talk a little bit about your core arguments, and then we'll talk a little bit about the alternative point of view, what a private equity manager, fund manager might say that you miss or you don't understand, and we'll have some dialogue about that. So really appreciate you guys taking the time to chat today.
Great. Thank you, Doug. And so, let me say that for a long time, Martin and I have been talking about this question of what has happened to American communities, rising income inequality, and what are the explanations that people proffer and how valid are they? And so people will say, well, American industry has lost due to globalization. But actually, excitingly, the Nobel Prize was just awarded for research that looks at the link between technological progress and economic growth. And I mean, this is very much a Schumpeterian perspective where we expect that new industries will arise so that industries for which we are no longer competitive will move offshore, but then higher value added activities will take root in the American economy and provide employment opportunities. And that hasn't happened. And as someone who studies university tech transfer and sort of commercialization of science, what I observe is that there are so many wonderful ideas that are percolating, but companies have a hard time getting financing. And as Martin and I talked about this and sort of looking at what has happened to towns, for example, there's a book called Glass House, which looks at anchor hocking in the area outside of Columbus, Ohio, and how that company was sort of lost its edge and then received private equity investment and ultimately closed. And it's a story that's been repeated across the American landscape, where there used to be a lot of geographic specialization in different places. Companies, one company or a small cluster of companies co-locating and really being competitive and providing high quality jobs. But that has largely changed. And so it's just, I won't speak for Martin, but thinking about why this happened, we also see correspondingly a decrease in local banking and just the availability of finance. And private equity has emerged as a model that commands just so significant resources. And we know that any economic activity requires financing. The way in which we have chosen to finance large swaths of our economy has been really detrimental to local areas. And in looking at this, public policy has created incentives for private equity, has made private equity so very lucrative, and it could be relatively easy to change and to have greater capital availability and then allow for investments in places so that new industries, new firms could take root.
And so Martin, maybe talk a little bit about what was your personal motivation for writing this book about private equity and its impact on communities?
So for many years, I studied the venture capital industry, and private equity sort of spun out of the venture capital industry sort of in the early, late 70s, early 80s. And I was so, as I studied venture capital, which is investing in growth, I started to look at these private equity firms also, and their investments in communities in such a variety of areas. I think Marianne and I started thinking about industry, manufacturing, shall we say, which is where the first wave of the private equity folks invested. And as Marianne ably described, many of these firms, manufacturing firms, Anker Hawking, Houdail Machinery, et cetera, received private equity investment. But then what private equity did is it offshored that work, fired the workers, eliminated very often their pension funds, bankrupted their pension funds, put them on the pension guarantee, Federal Pension Guarantee Corporation. But then as we started to look at it, we go, oh my gosh, they're in funeral homes. They're in hospitals. They're in emergency rooms. And what sort of, oh, I won't speak for Marianne, but I think our scales sort of drop from our eyes and we go, oh my God, they are everywhere, investing everywhere, all through the kidneys, nursing homes, et cetera. And then as we started to dig deeper into other people's research, we saw, oh my God, after private equity invests in nursing homes, you get more deaths. After they invest in funeral homes, you get add-on services in dentistry, smiles, miles of smiles, a dentistry operation. That's private equity. And all of a sudden you read about it and you see, oh my God, they're upselling people or removing teeth that don't need to be removed. And then we started to get a picture of private equity bringing a recipe to every investment. Decrease wages, lay off as many of the higher skilled employees in that operation as possible, upsell the patients, offshore or lower the quality, and so various ways to extract as much value from their investment as possible. And then at the end, if the firm is just a husk or the hospital is just a husk, close the hospital and walk away. And so, you know, rural hospitals all across the country have gotten private equity investment. And then within 2, 3, 4 years, the hospital goes bankrupt or it's closed down and merged with a hospital 50 miles away. And so this happened in rural hospitals, but it also happened in urban settings where hospitals were bought by private equity, slowly run down. The value was extracted and they were closed. And so I think as Marianne and I went through this process from the beginning, we didn't know what we were going to see at the end, which just opened our eyes. And then Marianne described a trip she took cross country from North Carolina to Arizona through all of these towns, rural towns throughout the United States. And she had her eyes open and she goes, oh my God. look at what's happened to all of these towns. And then that connected back to our community development interests. And I think really by the end of this, we were shocked and almost scandalized. I can't speak for Marianne. But...
No, very much scandalized. And, you know, we draw on a lot of research that has been done over the years that documents the movement of private equity, again, from industrial concerns, where you might argue the restructuring of Nabisco, the idea of barbarians at the gate, you have bloated conglomerates, and there were efficiency gains. And that model proved to be so lucrative that Martin and I write about this as cradle to grave. And so right now, childcare providers, you know, Bright Horizons, KinderCare, Primrose Schools, I mean, these are all private equity backed. And what happens is they move into an area, they buy up different operations that are ongoing. They create local monopolies so that they can charge what they want. But also, Doug, what's really pernicious is where you used to have, let's say, a variety of local owners, you now have shifted ownership to a location far away, primarily Wall Street, right? And you have lost that sort of local attention, devotion to the economy, the investment in civic capital. And, you know, providing funding for the local Little League or for cultural events. And so it just, you know, it decreases the amount of social capital and really the ability of places to restructure. So people who were previously sole proprietors, doctors who owned their practices now become employees. And so the locus of control has shifted away.
And so what does, let's talk a little bit about the, you know, I loved how your book.
I would like to add one thing.
Oh, sure.
Doug,
yeah.
What Marianne said.
Go ahead.
I mean, today we're questioning why our defense industry isn't doing so, isn't sort of fully up to par. And then you start to look and you go, oh my God, private equities in defense. So it's cradle to grave, and it's across all of these various sectors. I mean, what was so shocking is that any sector we sort of came up with, and oh, let's look at, you know, renal care. Oh, there they are. Look at emergency rooms. Emergency
ambulances.
Rooms.
Ambulances.
I mean, storage, storage facilities. What are the mobile home parks?
Right.
Where
the housing market in general. Yes.
In general.
I want to talk about the connection. You know, your book is private equity. It's not private equity and, you know, the consolidation of industries or private equity and investment returns. It's private equity and the demise of the local. And Marianne, you started to talk on that, about that. What is the relationship between private equity and place? What is the mechanisms for how private equity is somehow, you know, it's your term, you know, and there's a demise of the local. What is the relationship between private equity and communities?
Right. And so, you know, right now we have with the retirement of the baby boom generation, right, a lot of people are retiring. Second generation maybe doesn't want to come in to take over ownership and management of those operations. And so companies are up for sale. And private equity has such a large backing that it can come in and set the price. This is particularly true with young physicians who have the double whammy of coming out of medical school with large amounts of debt. And so when they look to buy a practice, they're competing with private equity firms. They're already in a great amount of debt, and they don't have the financial resources to buy those practices. And so, one of the things that private equity does is that it comes in and it will use a company or a, medical practice or a facility, an establishment's assets as debt to finance the takeover. And so then that settles this local entity with a large amount of debt, which it has to repay. And so then the way to repay that is to cut back on employment and quality. And I mean, we just see this repeated in so many different locations and across so many sectors.
Oops.
We have also, when companies, are sort of taken over, there's a professional management. Much of this is facilitated by digital platforms. Well, you don't have to have a property manager at an apartment building site. You simply manage it remotely. And so losing that sort of connectivity and sort of the human touch, so that everything becomes financialized and a transaction. We've even in our interviews and in reading, some of the when private equity will come in, they will require their managers to not live in the community, to commute at greater distance so that they don't become attached to the local community, so that they don't have any qualms about firing people.
You
And
heard
so,
that you heard this in some of your interviews.
yes, we have a quote. We actually have a quote in the book where, this was a requirement.
Because then they don't they if you're embedded locally, you have reputational concerns, you have trust concerns, you're maybe building relationships that would incentivize you maybe to not do those things. And so the idea was to keep them in another place, and that allows them to be more just purely financially oriented.
Right, exactly. Right.
I think the Marianne alluded to this earlier. It's this idea of social capital, but also local capital in the sense of money that could be invested to build a firm, to help the local governments. And also the other thing that Marianne didn't mention is local newspapers.
Oh,
They
yes.
were bought up by private equity also, and eventually replaced by articles that are written somewhere, and then just like a syndication, but not even a syndication. So that happened. Or offshoring newspaper article writing to India, where it could be less expensive. So the whole goal of private equity is to a return on capital as rapidly as possible. And everything in the firm is bent to that particular goal, extract capital as quickly as possible, because you want return to your investors. It's ROI, and it's ROI over time. So the more rapidly you extract the wealth, the better your ROI is, which makes it easier to raise a new fund, right? And of course, you get the management fees, and you get the carried interest. Which is, if there's a capital gain, you get between 10 or 30%. It's somewhere in that range. And you collect a management fee of 10 of 1, 2, 3% a year over the raised corpus of capital, right?
Right.
So,
And so that's why we're seeing these funds get so incredibly large, right? Because the private equity partners are getting a return, an annual return on the amount of capital that they have invested. And they have management fees that just make it very, very lucrative. And with all this money, and we should mention that where does this money come from? Well, it's wealthy individuals, but it's also university endowments and it's pension plans, foundations, pension plans. And so it is the sort of institutions that we believe should be creating social capital and equity that are investing in these operations that actually sort of take wealth away from the places where the workers and the retirees and the institutions are based.
So let's talk a little bit about, so you have a few mechanisms here then of, private equity comes in and buys some businesses in a place, and they're incentivizing, folks not to live in that place, not to fly in from somewhere else, because that avoids the reputation and some of the other network dynamics that might make them less inclined to be more financially focused, let's say. When you've got ownership of businesses that are placed in an or owned in another place, you don't have maybe those same people, those investors who are serving on some of the boards and part of the civic life, the school district, the little league, that sort of thing. If you're not based in a place, you don't have shame as a kind of a regulator of behavior, right? Because you're located someplace else. You lose that kind of control over decision making if all the investment capital is placed paste place paste based someplace else. Sorry about that. In another location. And so you have all these mechanisms at work that are pulling then control from a middle America town to a coast, to a big city. Is that typically where these funds then concentrate?
They concentrated basically New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, with New York and Boston, but with the New York having the preponderance. I think, Doug, you phrased it very well, and I think it's that they don't care about the local. They're not embedded in the local, and they don't care. They can't care because the goal is maximum financial return. Whereas, if you care about a place, that wouldn't be your only motivation. So I think that what you capture is that what's being captured and what we saw is they don't care. They don't care about the local. They don't care about the workers. They don't care about the patients. They don't care about really anything except the extraction of wealth.
This is the rise of really shareholder capitalism, right? Where, I mean, the older model was that corporations viewed themselves as having some responsibility to a wider range of stakeholders. And that included workers and suppliers and communities. And then as, sort of starting in the 70s, and we talk about this was sort of a fun, historical journey of how that has really changed and how everything became financialized. Everything was about the, maximum ROI and then returning money to investors and not really caring about ethical business practices, caring about social benefit or what was happening to the environment or anything else. And places have just been, one of the losers in this situation.
So if let me take the defenders of private equity and their argument. So they would argue this is the free market at work. Pension funds, universities, other folks are depending on them for returns. How is it fair for the firefighter who's depending on a pension to not have, their pension paid for because they're the private equity fund is conceding on a return to do something good for the community or to do some kind of win-win locally or to engage philanthropically. So how do you, what do you say to those, to that argument that, you know, the returns of these funds are good people that should be getting as best, the best return they possibly can get?
You know, it's actually studies have documented that these investments in private equity, when you take out all of the management fees, don't return that much. That really, you know, in pension funds might do just as well to stay with more middle of the road investments. So that's one point. The other, the free market argument, I mean, Doug, there is so much government subsidy flying back to these places. When you invest in nursing home and daycare centers, drug treatment, you know, there's a lot of government money that buoys up and makes these operations profitable. You know, there's another argument, which is that private equity now invests in essential services that we need to purchase. And our demand for these is going to be, you know, an economist would say, relatively inelastic, which means that we will pay what the price is because we need dental care and we need child care. But these costs have really gotten out of control. And so, is
So,
that free market? If only this were really a free market.
okay.
What
I mean,
do
I
you say,
think
Martin?
the other thing,
Oh, the other thing is that, of course, it's the taxes and the tax code that private equity, through our legislators, have shaped over the last 25 or 30 years. As they become wealthier, they pour more money into our politicians. More and more of our politicians are private equity principals. And so, in fact, they use, Marianne is absolutely right. On one side, it's Medicare, Medicaid, all of those things that are paying private equity, the private equity firms that own these firms that provide the services. So on that side, child care, when Obama, I think it was Obama, passed child care legislation, private equity went in and bought up the child care operators, often sole proprietor operators, bought them up, and then raised prices and pushed private equity, push the government to pay more. We know when they take over a nursing home, an emergency room, a renal care facilities, they upcode to the insurance companies. So across, this is, they're looking for places where there's not a free market, where they can create a monopoly so that they can raise prices.
And study after study has documented in nursing homes, in renal care facilities, in emergency rooms, when you have a private equity operator, you have worse health outcomes.
So what do you say then about the fact that so many of these large, you know, I'm thinking about the Yale Endowment, Harvard's endowment, these large institutional players still continue to pour money into private equity. If it was such a bad return, or they're not actually getting there, why do they continue to do it, do you think?
So there's a there's let me just and then I
Okay.
have to run. There's a number of reasons, Mary. But one of them is that in the 80s, it started to become accepted wisdom that you should put a part of your portfolio in what are called alternative investments, which was private equity. And so part of that was that they actually changed the way pension fund, the prudent managers of pension
Right.
funds, endowments, etc., should invest their money. And they started to put it into private equity. And there's research, and there's also court documents that show that that private equity actually misrepresents its returns. There's now a suit going on in Kentucky on this very issue, that they misrepresent their returns to their investors, who are supposed to be sophisticated investors like our pension funds, but when they're up against these private equity and funds, we find out that they're not quite as sophisticated. And there's been research that shows that if you'd invested in an S&P index fund, you would have done better than if you had invested in private equity. Now, the other thing we have to understand is that the returns to private equity are very skewed. So some private equity firms do very well. Many do not so well. And when you average it, what you find is that the returns are not as good as the S&P. But if you got into one of the lucky or successful funds, you would have had higher returns.
Right. So, and this lack of transparency is, yes, Martin, thank you. Good to see you.
Thank you so much, Doug and Marianne, and I apologize for having to leave.
That's okay. See you, Martin.
Yep. Bye-bye.
The lack of transparency makes it very difficult for people to make informed decisions, which is why this new proposal that individuals be allowed to invest in private equity is very, very problematic.
Okay.
I feel that there just needs to be more understanding of this problem, and that's what we had hoped to shed light on, and really if we want to grow local economies, we need local investment.
So let's talk about that. At Sleeping Giant, we're trying to pioneer a place-based alternative. We invest, only here in West Michigan with, West Michigan Capital and back West Michigan aspiring owner operators. And we have a strong connection here to Western Michigan University. So we'd love to talk to you about some alternatives. What are the emerging alternatives you see for, all these baby boomers who are retiring? If they didn't want a private equity option, what are the new models that you're excited about or what you see as alternatives to this dilemma?
Right. I mean, I think that this is, it's a really important question. And, it is something I think that, again, we can look at different alternative types of policies. I would love to see more local banking because local banking is based on relationships. You are more than your credit score, right? And so, that would go a long way. I want to mention for too many years of my life, I've been studying the Small Business Innovation Research Program, the SBIR program, which provides, it's called America's Seed Capital Fund. And it currently has expired and has not been renewed by Congress. And so, again, there is a sort of battle ongoing about who controls this program and do companies need to have a private equity, a private investment match to money that they're getting from the government. I think that we can, I don't know this idea of what individuals can do. We see a lot of family funds who are investing in places, trying to, again, people believe in places and they want to champion growth and investment in those places. And they have a longer time horizon. So one of the things, again, when we're focused on the rate of return and a high rate of return, I think a question to ask ourselves is, what is a reasonable rate of return? And, we're always trying to go for the max, recognizing that, we have very skewed distributions, right? A few things will be home runs and will create a lot of money. But a viable way to build a local economy is to have many small and medium-sized firms. and to have these as sort of interrelated, to have supplier networks that are very rich and very, very specialized. And so that is a way for growth. I mean, other models like employee ownership, right? Co-ops, other kinds of things. I mean, I love the idea of wealthy individuals who make money in Silicon Valley, cash out, and then go back to their local communities and make investments. But I think also we need more vehicles. And I mean, Martin and I say the next thing we need to do is to write the sort of other half of this. It was really depressing to look at how private equity has yielded so much destruction to local economies. But where are these sort of sparks of light, and how can people invest? And I've heard some, and again, just some individuals saying that rather than sending their money to Wall Street, they would much rather invest in a local enterprise where they could watch it. And, they might offer some business advice. They could serve on the boards. But we don't make that very easy for people to do. So we've sort of centralized finance and really consolidated it. And there is just not, not enough options.
Are there any particular firms that you're really excited about who are providing an alternative in particular that you'd want people to know about?
Well, I think your model, your business model, Doug, is really interesting if you want to talk a little bit about that, because it really is offering an alternative where, you are doing specific place-based investments, and things that would not really be of interest to larger venture capital firms or to private equity.
Yeah, I mean that's what we're trying to, maybe you'll write the book, hopefully you'll write the book on us as the sequel. I mean we're trying to be that place-based alternative to traditional private equity. We're buying West Michigan businesses. We're a majority buyer, so we're not growth capital. We acquire those businesses by raising money locally. And we are training and supporting and backing an entrepreneur who would become the new owner operator of that business. And then always trying to find the win-win relationships with our university here at Western Michigan University, but also with our service providers to, create the incentives that, they would want to refer opportunities to us because they know that we'll engage, in business with them. And so trying to create that virtuous cycle between the investment capital, the entrepreneurship, the place-based investment opportunities, the service providers. What's been kind of fun for us in the last month or so, I was on a podcast recently called Acquiring Minds, and I've had I don't know, probably a dozen people reach out to me from Mississippi and Florida and Virginia and Indiana and Ohio, inspired by the model that we're creating as something that's an alternative to, keep capital, ownership, talent, control, local. So that's been really fun to see as, maybe we are onto something that's a new model.
Right. No, and I think that it will evolve. And I think that we're at a point where private equity has extracted so much value that they are not going to be able to find the investment opportunities. And there's so much dissatisfaction with service providers just across the board. Yet it's difficult for new firms to enter, right? And so in a free market, you might expect that if your car wash, and private equity owns car washes, and if they're doing a poor job, someone else would start a car wash and compete them out of business. But the problem is that the new car wash cannot get funding to even allow it to get started. And so, I mean, that's free market. And I think that, those are the kinds of things we could be be promoting. I think states' attorney generals should take this on, and that they can exert some power, break up some of these local monopolies, and provide greater oversight. So that the whole antitrust, I mean, this is where I think Lina Khan is to be commended, that our view of antitrust evolved. And we write about the Bork Doctrine, which said that you had to sort of show, that you were harming consumers, difficult to show. But if you can say that, no, you're harming other producers in an economy, in an industrial segment, then you have the basis for dismantling some of these firms.
So if we kind of close out here, if you were advising, business leaders, investors who, wanted to strengthen, their place and to see a dynamic that maybe wasn't, engaged with by private equity, what's the where did they start to think about this differently in their communities? Like, who is it the family offices that needs to kind of start this conversation? Is it the economic development people? Like, how does this dynamic change in a place that you'd recommend?
You
Is it
know, well, this,
policymakers?
right? And I think that, I mean, we know that when states have engaged in their own sort of venture capital funds, they have not done as well, right? And in their model is much more like giving a grant than making an investment. And I feel that this topic is ripe for more discussion. I'm very dismayed when I talk to people in local ecosystems and they say, we need to bring in venture capital, and that's the way we'll grow our local ecosystem. Well, you can get venture capital investment, but they're very likely to invest in that company for 5 to 7 years. IPOs are really rare events, and so it's much more likely that their investments will be sold. And then moved out of that location that incubated them. And so I think that we do need to see more creativity here. So Doug, that is, I think, the challenge. And I think it's something that because people haven't recognized this as a problem, that we're not seeing much activity. But I think firms like yours that are starting to percolate are beginning to do this.
So if there's folks want to learn a little more about your research, Marianne, or the book, where do they just buy the can they buy the book on Amazon? Where do they go?
You can buy the book on Amazon. It's Cambridge University Press. It's actually, very a very different kind of book that Martin and I have written in the past, because we usually write books with equations and, and much more complicated. This is about 80 pages, and it's meant to be read in one sitting. And I mean, we go through and just talk about how this model is so different, how it has evolved, when it made sense and maybe was adding economic value and creating efficiencies, to how it has sort of taken over our economy, and then the way it affects, I mean, again, cradle to grave. And it's affecting things like housing availability. And many times we don't sort of point this out as being a problem. Healthcare costs and problems with quality of healthcare. And so, I mean, I feel that we've kind of hit at a root cause for something that has been enabled by public policy and might be changed by public policy.
Well, it was great to read your book. I love how you started off with the series Yellowstone, and the idea of the Dutton farm, and the Dutton farm has been there for 140 years next to Yellowstone, and the whole story there of Kevin Costner and the ranch and the and who's coming to buy up their land. It's the real estate, back private equity people, and that whole dynamic. And you think about that show, you think about even some of the Trump tariffs and keeping America first and trying to onshore things, that this notion of capital in place is much more in the zeitgeist today. And so your book is great, Private Equity and the Demise of the Local. It was fun to be able to chat with you about this. I know we've been trying to set this up for quite a while, but a great read for people who are interested in private equity, its impact on place, and look forward to keeping in touch. And if you want to continue your research or explore this, would love to be a part of it.
Very good. Doug, thank you so much for this opportunity. And again, I'm at Arizona State University, easy to contact if anyone has questions or comments. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you, Marianne.